I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Ad-Lloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
the Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ad's Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you.
This week's book guest is Persuasion by Jane Austen.
What's it about? Persuasion is about Anne Elliot, who years after breaking off an engagement, finds herself having to encounter her ex, and he's even fitter and wealthier.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, the truly strange thing about this novel is that at the age of 27, Anne is considered really bloody old to still be on the shelf.
In this episode, we discuss Lyme Regis,
Prince George,
slippy cobstones,
hot looks,
and sailors,
and hot men writing hot stuff down in hot letters.
And joining us this week is Andrew Hunter Murray. Andrew is a polymath of talent, a QI elf, a globally famous podcast host with his award-winning show No Such Thing as a Fish, and a Sunday Times best-selling author with his books The Last Day and The Sanctuary. His new book, A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering, will be published in 2024. Thank you for joining us, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited you're here. When this author came up, there was only one person we could think
yes,
that could have possibly studied her at Oxford in the level that you have.
Right.
I know for a fact that you know at least two people who've done that, but yes, yeah.
Yeah, but just for our listeners, I mean, you don't have a casual interest in
no,
Jane Austen.
You're not
either of you.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You've made
that's
quite a lot of money out of...
We have dug up that corpse and improvised on top of it for some time.
Because that's my first question to you both, really.
Oh, yeah.
And I think lots of people.
Where is Ostentatious available to watch? It's on at the Arts Theatre every Monday, Sarah.
Okay. My second question, and I think lots of readers, if they were discovering Austen for the first time now, or if they were forced perhaps to read for school
she's still
or
whatever. Syllabus, I think.
Yeah. Is she funny?
Go on, Andy.
She's very funny.
She's so funny.
And in fact, it gets funnier the more you read it. That's a really interesting thing.
Yes.
There are some gags which are obvious, and there are some gags which are just pure character moves, and there are some which are so subtly layered in that actually we went to an event where they were reading the whole of Pride and Prejudice at Bath Library over the course of about 3 days,
including some of the cast of the best adaptation, the 1995 BBC PMP.
Yes,
so Mr. Bingley. Mr. Bingley,
what's his name, Crispin Bonham Carter,
correct.
Some relation.
Rachel
yep.
Paris got a picture next to him. We were so excited.
I had no idea this was going to be such a dweeb off.
No.
So, I don't know why you're surprised.
All of us are reading it, and I think a few of us
read
a chapter each.
Yeah.
And you know, and the weird thing is, more jokes came out of the text as we read
it. Live reading.
I'd already read it a couple of times by that point, and yet, when you read it really closely, it gets funnier and funnier because the author is always, she's always in there, or the narrator rather, she's always in there gently reminding you of her presence and observing things that you can observe too, if you're minded to.
It's constant observation and it's constant character observation and watching people and then it's stand-up.
But I would say that we're dealing with Persuasion today.
We are dealing with Persuasion.
This is far bitchier in those character observations than Pride and Prejudice. I felt like she twinkled. It was that kind of comic.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
She's a stand-up comedian, whereas this one, she was there's a couple of people she absolutely roasted.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She roasted them.
This is the last novel she wrote. Yeah. It was completed.
She was dead when it was published.
Yeah, it was published in December 1817, along with Northanger Abbey, 6 months after her death.
And she died at 41, which is younger than me. That's your age, Carrie.
All right. I need to write some more books.
Also, imagine the weirdness of getting Persuasion
and Northanger Abbey.
And Northanger Abbey at the same time, which she wrote when she was about 17.
I thought that. I was like, you'd be like, this author's really weird.
It's a slightly sort of kooky gothic comedy.
But so I read another interesting thing, that most of her novels she revised and revised and revised, apart from Persuasion, which was written in the last two to three years. And she did edit it.
So she would have revised this.
So
had she
Pride and Prejudice was written for like 10 years. So like this was like only for about 2 years. And they still have some of the edits, and you can see like handwritten what she was, how she was refining the comedy and refining the writing, basically. But this was the last one. And it's always, it's famous for being her most mature novel. And, you know, it is about older characters. It is about older romance. That we'll come back to that.
Yes.
Older word. Yes. But yes, compared to Pride and Prejudice, I would say Pride and Prejudice is frothy. It's champagne. Mm. It's delight. It's joy. This is...
A Negroni.
A Negroni. Yeah. A dark whiskey. Yeah. Like it's dark and stormy. It's rum.
It's someone who's had too many drinks, guys.
Yeah. And it's like, well, let me tell you.
No, I like her. I like her. What I don't like is the freckles. I don't like her. She's got that tooth. What's that? What's going on with her wrist?
Yeah.
Her description of Mrs. Clay. Oh, I was like, God, you'd be cancelled now for saying, oh, this person is not just unattractive. Let me list their faults.
There are some really unbearable rudeness in there.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's got, I think, one of the only really, really cruel comments in the whole of Austen's canon, which is about a mother who's lost her son at sea.
And she says, with a woman this fat, she should be much jollier. That character who is dead, who we hear of a couple of times via his mother's grief, and Jane Austen's narrator saying, "Nah, it's rubbish."
He wasn't much.
Well,
good.
It's a dick joke actually as well. I mean, I didn't know
she
that
covers all bases, guys.
I didn't know they did dick jokes back in the day, but his name was Richard.
Yeah, they did. They'd
been calling him Poor Richard.
Yeah,
Poor Richard had been nothing better than a thick-headed, unfeeling, unprofitable Dick Musgrove who had never done anything to entitle himself to more than the abbreviation of his name. Living or dead.
Yeah.
Their son died. Don't care about that. He was rubbish. That's what she says. And I was so shocked.
You tricked us. You said, is she funny? And we went, yes. And then you brought up all the things she said that should be cancelled.
Yes, there are more jokes in Persuasion which would get a kind of a Jimmy Carr style laugh than a ooh.
Yes.
Yeah. I think the thing with Austen often is that you have these concentric circles of reality and character depth. The heroines are obviously the most real people. They're drawn with the most depth and warmth, and they're often their close family are drawn with a similar amount of warmth, not really in this case. And then you get these concentric circles of more and more absurd characters around them stretching into the distance.
Yes. Which Pride and Prejudice is a classic example of Lizzie Bennet, you like, and then the parents are mental, and then the other characters are.
Exactly. The Reverend Collins, nut job. Lady Catherine de Bourgh, really nuts. You know, and they're allowed to be comic characters the further away they are from the sort of iron core of the novel. Lots of the family are just in that slightly more absurd outer circle. Because so much of it is about her father, Sir Walter
her
Elliot.
Dad's so vain.
Well, it's so funny. I mean, I didn't think that people, that men at the time, had such an important place, such importance on their appearance.
Yes.
But from the very first page, Sir Walter.
It's the first thing you know about him, he doesn't read books.
It says,
he's so vain.
Vanity was the beginning and the end of Sir Walter Elliot's character. Vanity of person and of situation. Few women could think more of their personal appearance than he did, nor could the valet of any new-made lord be more delighted with the place he held in society. It's just like, it's so damning.
I know.
But it's not just, he likes how he looks. He's so judgmental about all men,
especially
sailors. And when he goes to Bath, he keeps calling women frights down the street, saying there aren't enough pretty women.
I read an interesting thing that which I don't know if I agree with, was supposed to be a metaphor for Prince George. The regent, that is this character that is too vain, and that's spoiling the country, and that's the problem. And he doesn't support the navy, which apparently Prince George was very rubbish at. And then when they defeated Napoleon, he took the credit, whereas everyone was like, it was the navy, mate, not you.
Well, two of her brothers were in the navy.
Yes.
So that ending of the book where it's like, this one goes out to all the troops.
Let's hear it for the boys.
And the fact that so often they kept talking about, you know, the great characters of the navy.
Well, it's big time for the navy.
The dad keeps saying things like, like, oh, they should all be knocked on the head.
Well, yeah.
Because they're so, there's this thing about an admiral who's looks 62 when he's only 40.
I know, because the vanity.
And then, but there's a whole passage, which is not a character, it's the narrator.
Oh, talk, when she goes on about the Navy.
But well, how all jobs make you ugly.
Is that bit?
Well, I'll find it for you.
I think that's a character. I think it's...
It is a character, you're right.
Maybe it's Anne's older sister.
So oh, is Elizabeth?
Or it might be Mrs. Clay. Oh, it's Mrs. Clay, the manipulative hussy of the book.
Oh, Mrs. Clay. I loved Mrs. Clay. And then she sort of has to like mysteriously get, yeah, removed every now and again when she can sense everyone realizes she's trying to shack up with the dad.
She does seem to be.
It's page 21, so it's pretty early on. It is Mrs. Clay. And she's saying, I've been long convinced, though every profession is necessary in its turn, for those who are not obliged to follow any, who can live in a regular way in the country, choosing their own hours, following their own pursuits, and living their own property without the torment of trying for more, it is only their lot to hold the blessings of health and good appearance. Don't get a job or you're going to get ugly, she says. And all you know about her, she's covered in freckles.
Yep.
And considered very unattractive.
Well, it's interesting as well, because the Navy at that time, again, something I was reading, is a meritocracy. So someone like Captain Wentworth, who we haven't mentioned, the dashing hero of the piece, Captain Frederick Wentworth, is able
to... It's not my hero.
Not your hero, okay. But he's able to make his money in a way that her father is completely of the baronet, you know...
Inherited wealth. And
the Navy at that time, you could get prize money. That's what her brothers did. They made prize money. They shared it with their other sailors. So this is a whole new class developing.
Yeah. Which
that Anne is pro and Anne is... And also those people had just won.
But the other characters are quite kind of sniffy about.
Oh, yeah, it's definite sniffiness. But it's interesting that our character, Anne, who, you know, Jane's voice in this, is not sniffy about it and is pointing out, like, we just won a war. Yeah. We just stopped the French invading us because of these men.
And so Walter explicitly says, I disapprove of the Navy because you don't know who you're going to have to salute.
You
might have to salute someone whose dad your father wouldn't have given the time of day to.
Yeah.
This is outrageous.
So it's interesting that, again, this is why I love Jane Austen, because it's funny, it's thoughtful, and woven in very subtly is a complete class debate going on of, like, what does it mean to be, you know, part of a society, a hierarchy? And we have this person, you know, her father, who is, you know, everyone should, if you know, doff their cap to him, but he's vain and stupid and useless.
Also, he's run out of money.
He's got no bloody money.
So his snobbery about people who have gone out and worked for a living, and not just worked honourably, and, you know, saved us from Napoleon and inverted commas.
That's the phrase I used.
Hang on.
I mean, he did save us from Napoleon.
Is this a pro-Napoleon podcast? Because I would never have said yes to a period.
I support the troops, all the troops, both sides. Okay?
We'll be recording from a small island in the Mediterranean.
A complete tangent, but that was the big threat that Napoleon posed, particularly in England, was that he represented a more meritocratic...
Yeah.
As ever with dictators, they all go tonto and then might try and make their sons the subsequent dictator. But Napoleon in the early days was seen as a meritocrat. And France post-revolution was not a safe place for people who hadn't worked to achieve their station in life. So that is an interesting sort of side point to this.
But the point about money, and Jane Austen often does this to show us weak men.
Mm.
Same with Elizabeth Bennet's father. Later on with the Mr. Smith that we hear about. But... You know, our main vain character can't afford to live in his house anymore.
And won't sell it out of pride.
Won't solve the problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is still so proud. And he's making other people sort it out for
him. I know. And the fact that he can't, you know, if you haven't read it, he can't afford to stay in his house. So they rent it out to an admiral. But they have to sort of trick him and manipulate him into it so that it's sort of an admiral that's okay, even though he's an admiral, because he's sort of polite and you know, everyone likes this admiral.
The really funny bits where the poor land agent, the guy who's actually running the estate, Mr. Shepherd, is having to persuade Sir Walter, firstly, that you have to rent out your house. And secondly, well, obviously we won't advertise it. You know, we will sort of let it be known that if someone wants the great privilege of renting out your house and saving your bacon, maybe we'll let them do it.
Yeah. With a number of restrictions.
You won't be allowed to go into the pleasure garden, of course. And you won't be able to go into...
You can't look at those flowers and you can't go in that bit.
Really funny.
What I love later on is when the tenant is reflecting on his time at the house how many mirrors the guy has.
Because he talks about, like, Sir Walter's changing room, doesn't he? He's like, oh, we had to get rid of all those mirrors. It was a bit weird. It's a bit much. And they're like, and they sort of assume it's one of the girls, don't they? And like, Anne is a bit like, oh, God. He's a fantastic character, Sir Walter.
He is. Brilliantly drawn.
He's so funny. He's
and the book
so
starts funny. With him. He is, in a way, the main character. Not really, but it's he sort of sets up the initial
the world,
debate and the world and the questions that Austen's looking at, particularly in this one, because there, all of Austen's novels are dealing with similar questions, but sometimes particular ones are more sharp.
But we also need to find her family flawed so that the decision she made 8 years ago when she turned down this suitor, which is, you know, the romance, which is my next question, is this a romance?
Yeah.
If you find it romantic. So we have to judge them as people who would make wrong decisions or would, that Anne's right and they're wrong.
But then it's what I love about Jane Austen, right? I think she's a genius, is you have this horrible father character, these awful sisters. So her older sister sort of, you know, also vain and just has slipped into the role of mother. Her younger sister, Mary, married this other person and thinks she's better than everybody. 8 years ago, Anne had an engagement offered and she was...
But she was in love, more or less.
She was in love. She was in love and an engagement was offered as well. And she was persuaded to turn it down, not particularly by the awful family, but by a dear family friend, Lady Russell. Is Lady Russell?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And that's what I think so good about Jane Austen, because it would be, if it was just like, oh, my dad told me to say no to Captain Wentworth because he was poor and a sailor, and my dad's an arsehole. It's like, well, that's the kind of level of storytelling. Like, okay, fine. But what she does is gives that decision to someone that Anne loves and cares for and is respected. So you see the torment of like my replacement mother, my mum dies at 14, my replacement mother, who is the only member of my extended family who thinks I'm worthy, thinks I'm interesting, cares about me.
Lady Russell was protecting the family's status.
Yes.
It wasn't about, you know, happiness.
No.
It was just...
But as Anne says, she was wrong, even though Anne is very polite about it and is like, oh, it was still the right decision. And, you know, she doesn't go around to Lady Russell being like, fuck you, well, you ruined my life.
She doesn't bear a grudge.
No.
And that's really interesting because, again, Austen's heroines, I think there are loads of ways you can divvy them up. But one of the key things about Austen's heroines is they're either usually flawed or pretty well flawless.
Yes.
So Elizabeth Bennet is flawed. She has to overcome her judgments of Darcy and so on. So, but then you've got someone like Fanny Price in Mansfield Park,
who doesn't
really put a foot wrong for the whole novel.
Yeah.
And I think Anne Elliot probably is in the flawless camp as well. Although I'm interested to hear you say that you think she's flawed.
Yeah, I do.
What flaws do you think she has?
Well, this is what I found, having read it the first time years ago, when we were in Ostentatious every Monday at the Arts Theatre, I read it much more as like a typical Austen woman who's very lovely and genteel and reads books and is kind, and her family just almost Matilda, her family don't notice that she's in the wrong family. But rereading it, I was like, she describes so much all the time that her family are judgmental and this. She's so quick to judge people. Now, she does it in a really intelligent, funny way, but she often is wrong about people. And there is a bit at the end where I think it's Wentworth or Mr. Elliot says, like, that your expectations are too high to her. And she often, her description of what she expects of people, even though I'm not saying I'm a fan of Anne, she's kind, but the way that I think her standards are almost perfectionist.
And actually, I think I'm more in the Andy camp, where I think the way that the narrator tells us, that Anne is worthy feels unrealistic. Even to the point that her rejecting Wentworth, which was a mistake in terms of her own happiness and his own worth, and she's had to live with it for 8 years, and actually, if this was a realistic book, she'd never get him back. They still go, isn't it better to be persuaded than jump off a wall twice and break your head? It's like, come on.
I've been to that Cobb.
We went
to the Cobb. We had a gig down in Lyme Regis and we all went and took pictures.
Is it as fashionable as the back of this book tells me?
It's exciting, but we were in Regency dress on the Cobb joking around. Then we all went, actually, let's get off. This is a bit scary.
Yeah.
It's very high.
It's really
high. Did anyone think you were ghosts?
No, it's Lyme Regis. Lots of people look dressed in Regency gear. Let's talk about Anne and Captain Wentworth.
Okay.
So number one, she's 28 and they're acting like she's 105.
Well, in Regency times, that is 105. But that is basically the huge thing in the novel, that at 28, it's over. You're on the shelf, time's up, you didn't marry in time. And it's quite a big thing that her younger sister is married over the older sisters.
Yeah.
So for her and Elizabeth, that is a bit embarrassing.
Galling.
It's galling. Even though she, as we find out, actually rejected her sister's husband.
Yes.
That he wanted to marry her. And all his family keep saying, we wish she'd married you because your sister's such a pain in the ass.
And also they seem to get on really well.
They get on really well. But she didn't want to take him on. Fair play. He's a bit annoying.
Charles Musgrove.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a kind of gently benevolent, but slightly inadequate. He's not up to... Anne's
intellect.
She tells us he doesn't read, which is the pointer in this book. She either tells us a character reads lots but too much poetry, or they don't read.
And so
Charles Winnow doesn't read, but he's all right.
So Anne rejects Captain Wentworth at a point in his career when he's basically not very rich. He goes away to sea. He ends up fighting a lot of battles, getting a lot of money, coming back, and everyone's like, oh shit. And then he bumps into Anne. They have this moment of like, but it's so painful because it's Austen times that nobody says, oh my God, I haven't seen you for ages. They just have to not have conversations while being aware of each other in the room.
And the narrator stresses that lots of people don't know that they were attached
historically.
Yes, no
one knows.
It's only their Anne's father and older sister. Yeah, not even her younger sister doesn't know about it. And on his side, it's only his brother who's now left the country. So it's a completely unacknowledged relationship, and nothing is sexier.
Do you think it's sexier?
It's so...
I found it heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. Yeah. But,
and that's what makes you turned on. So.
But it's... In terms of romance, because all her previous novels, it's about whether two characters will or won't get together.
Yes, yes, yes.
Here, the fact that two characters so nearly did, they so nearly formed, and they're so right for each other.
They love it. They love each other.
They loved and it's love each not, other, and yet it didn't work. And it is heartbreaking. It's really... And
so there's a really beautiful quote on page 59, which feels just as modern, because it's all exes, really. Once so much to each other, now nothing.
Ugh. And then
now they were as strangers, nay, worse than strangers, for they could never become acquainted. It was a perpetual estrangement.
Oh.
So that's the situation she set up for us.
Listen to this one. She'd been forced into prudence in her youth. She learned romance as she grew older, the natural sequel of an unnatural beginning.
Well, that's so fascinating, because that's the lodestone of this book. So there's a little quote next to it, a little number. So Cassandra, when she read the first draft of this, so Jane Austen's sister, she wrote next to that, like, oh my God, like, this is so heartbreaking. This is the thing. Because this is Jane Austen's story.
That's what we need to talk about.
So
this is what happened to Jane.
So that's the quote. Jane Austen fell in love.
Yeah.
And was sort of connected to Tom Lefroy, and his family said, she's got no money, you can't do it, and they broke it off. And this is the fantasy of a 40-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's what I love again about Jane Austen. I think she's telling, like all good writers, the same story over and over again. And this could be viewed as Pride and Prejudice if they didn't get together and it was like 8 years on, if they'd met and it hadn't happened. And
allowed herself to be steered away from him.
Yeah, if she'd gone, if someone had said, oh, Darcy's awful, and she didn't. But I think she's always telling the same story, which is her story. And it is this heartbreaking that she didn't marry again. She never found, you know, that kind of romantic happiness. And so, of course, who better to write these novels that make us believe that even if after 8 years and he comes back rich, he won't have married someone else?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think the story she's telling again and again is a fantasy about men, which is, if you are a good enough woman, they don't move on. So Wentworth does have this whole speech about...
Yes.
You know, it was just you, and I've only loved you for 8 years. He would be riddled with venereal disease.
Come on,
he's a sailor.
He's been away. He's been on ship. He's
rich,
had
handsome,
the icon of
charming.
Her. No, I believe in Wentworth. Yes. Even if some of us around this table don't.
I believe in Wentworth.
I do.
Have you ever met a man, Andy?
Andy's met him. He's basing it on his own gallant self.
It just seems likely. I know what you mean. I do. It's funny because I think it's inevitable we will try and put our interpretation
of,
because we know about what happened in Austen's life.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that some of that went into it. I don't know if she and Tom Lefroy were, I don't know how close they were. Were they engaged?
Yes.
And then
it was a Regency engagement.
Were they fully engaged?
No, it weren't fully. I think they were promised.
Yeah.
And it was and then his family basically.
I think they wanted to. Yeah. His family. And then he was the Lord Chief Justice.
She was engaged to someone else with a mad name.
Mr. Harris Bigwither.
Bigwither.
She could have been Jane Bigwither.
That was for 24 hours and she broke it off.
She accepted the day and then woke up and was
she was
like,
never regretting that.
No, that Harris Bigwither. No, I don't. Oh, imagine poor Harris Bigwither's book.
I know. It's really
became an incel. He started using neuro-linguistic programming to manipulate girls into bed.
I wonder how much of Austen's real life did make it into particularly this story, because we know it's about someone who had a connection and then it was broken off.
Also,
I mean, she was also just a brilliantly creative person,
also,
and this was her palette she was drawing on.
Her sister Cassandra was betrothed and the fiancé died at sea.
Yes.
So I think it was for both of them there was this pain of, reflecting back on a life when you think nothing's going to happen for you now.
And the powerlessness of women at that time, that's it. You know, once his family said no, that's it. That's the end of that engagement.
But Austin had her, Austin's creative life
yes.
makes her very different to almost all women at the time. Yeah. And Amy from Ostentatious and I, we visited their house at Chawton. And it's where she was living with her sister and her mother in the later years of her life. I mean, not later because she died at 41, but they lived there. Austin worked on her books. There were sort of, they had lots of family connections. They had one of their, the Austin siblings had become incredibly wealthy and lived down the road.
One of the brothers.
I think it's Edward. He'd basically been adopted by the Knight family and he had become mega rich. As in they were so Austin visited, she was a devoted aunt to those children and she had a big influence on their lives. And this might be me just desiring a happy settled state for Austin, but she and her immediate family were in a pretty good place.
And I know what you're saying, but the woman who wrote this book, her heart is not happy.
Actually, there's a question that the introduction of this book poses, which maybe you two could tell me how you feel about it, which is that even if Wentworth and Anne didn't get together, that Anne would have been happy, and that is sort of suggested in her life.
Yeah, I do think
which
that...
Which would sort of ring true what
I know. Yeah, yeah, I think there's... That's why, again, I think the character of Anne is interesting, because you're not reading someone who will be completed by Wentworth. She has completely accepted that love is gone. She's never going to have it. There are other people that are interested in her, but she's like,
just playing piano in the corner unnoticed, her little fingers racing up and down.
She reads her poems and she's happy. And I definitely think she's not looking for a man to complete her. No. She's a fully formed character herself, but she loves Wentworth. That's the sort of irrationality versus rational.
But what we don't get told in this book, which we do get told a lot in Pride and Prejudice, is that where are the daughters going to go when Mr. Elliot inherits their house? She doesn't have a plan.
No,
that's true. But
it's never raised as jeopardy, though.
Yeah.
It's never raised as a serious
concern.
Lady
Russell is her friend. The Musgroves like her. You definitely get the feeling there's a network of support.
She'll sofa surf.
Jill Hornby is the writer who's written. She's written a book called Miss Austin, which is about Cassandra in later life, and it's looking back along the vista of her life and to when Jane was alive, and it's about because Cassandra burnt basically all the correspondence between the two of them, so we'll never really know what they said to each other, and that would have been the most open.
It's sisters. It would have been, why have you got my shoes? Have you seen my mascara?
I just want to read. This is depressing, but it just for me talks of the tension that Austin's characters have, because you're right, they are happy, they're okay, and they're also broken, which I think is humanity. So that's my take. Wentworth says to her, Mary, that that you were so altered he should not have known you again. And Mary says this really casually, and Anne is like, what? And so she doesn't say anything to Mary. She's like, all right. An altered bond beyond his knowledge. Anne fully submitted in silent, deep mortification. Doubtless it was so, and she could take no revenge, for he was not altered, or not for the worse. She had already acknowledged it to herself, and she could not think differently. No, the years which had destroyed her youth and bloom had only given him a more glowing, manly, open look, in no respect lessening his personal advantages. What she's talking about is women aren't allowed to age. Remember,
and also, he's been at sea for 10 years. He would look like an old piece of leather by now.
Between the lines of this is he got money now. He got.
Oh, do you think I? Yes. Do you know what I read?
He's attractive because he's rich.
No,
he's
got a nice tan.
Her self-esteem is on the floor. So even though she is obviously, clearly from everyone's description, a lovely, nice, genteel woman, great to have around, I think Anne thinks she's a piece of shit. And I think that's connected to her teenage grief and her family controlling her. If you grow up in a family where they basically ignore you...
Is Jane Austen writing about you, Carrie? Because I think that just became a little bit too autobiographical.
Look, if her big brother was like really loud and like way funnier, and she had to develop. Look, there's a bit where she goes to an improv class. This is the beauty of Jane Austen. Everyone can put herself on it. So why do you think it's all for the money then, Sarah?
Because what's really exciting about Jane Austen is finding human truths in her now, all these years later. But there's this other side, which is there are so many things that you sort of have to look over, which is the fact that this is a love story because he's rich. And I don't enjoy that.
Oh, do you think?
Otherwise, it's not a love story. It's another tragedy.
But they found the worth in each other when he was poor.
Yeah, she liked him before he was famous.
There is always, that's kind of it. There is always for women in these books a sense of where is the security going to come from? Because you don't want a sofa surf for the rest of your life. No. It's precarious.
And you have nothing else. I mean, if you're born into a certain class, there's nothing else you can do.
Exactly.
Obviously, Jane Austen wrote.
Yeah, so, and even that hadn't earned her huge amounts of money. No. By the
£10, her first publishing.
Yeah, by the time
this
happened.
She could have got some mascara for that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The brilliant thing about this one, and it's why I think it's a lot of people, Austen fans' favourite,
yes,
Austen.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Is it? She has
yeah,
had...
Yeah, it is, because it's so rich compared...
She had this love. It was taken away from her. This sort of terrible wound was inflicted on her, which then sort of was cauterized, healed over. And then he comes back, and it's as though the thing starts, it starts tingling again. And she thinks...
And she's going to watch him marry someone else, actually.
Yeah, one of these flighty Musgroves.
For a lot of the book. Is it
Musgroves.
Louisa and Henrietta Musgrove,
who are the sort of... They're her in-laws, aren't they?
And they're lovely girls.
They're lovely girls, but they're a bit kind of... They're a bit like Charles Musgrove. They don't really read very much. They don't have a life of the mind in the way that Austen
depicts. They like dancing.
Them. Yeah, they like going to dances. Yeah. I mean, you know.
And they're young. Yeah. They're young and flighty.
Exactly.
Everyone's
within a decade of each other here. That's a crazy thing.
Well, she, to be fair, she's 28 and they definitely come across as
they're
like
about 18.
18, 20.
Yeah.
And one of them's already betrothed to a neighbour anyway, which Mary Musgrove is hilarious. She is so funny about how much she hates the one she's got.
The surname Hater is a bit heavy
as well. The Reverend Hater?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah, name. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. But yeah, that I just, and there is this amazing poignant moment where Wentworth writes her a note, and this is the conclusion of the
book.
Again,
like
Pride
and Prejudice,
now.
When you have the note from Darcy, she does like her letters to cause the plots to change.
Yeah, and he writes her this note saying, "Look, I am half hope, half agony. Mm. You know, you pierce my soul. Please tell me if you feel remotely the same way." And it's, you know,
so
it's
as a writer,
moment.
I'm going to ask you about this letter writing, because when I got to that section of the book, I felt like she, as an author, couldn't show me what she needed to. You know, like in the films, the TV adaptations, they have incredible actors.
And they do the looks at everybody.
Looks that you can project onto.
Yeah.
And then they play those moments beat by beat with music, which is so atmospheric. Yeah. And a writer only has words.
Yeah.
And it sucks.
And you can't have a character being interrupted or him stumbling or being shy. So she has to write those letters because she has to give them essentially a monologue.
Yeah. I think it's a good narrative device, isn't it? It really allows them to...
It works. It works in Pride and Prejudice. We do it in Ostentatious.
Yeah. And she then sort of glosses over the walk they have afterwards.
Well, don't they immediately bump into someone?
Yes.
They immediately bump into, and they have to not say anything. And it is very funny when you read it. The emotional climax of both their lives has just happened. And then they bump into someone and they have to not talk about it.
Who's very jolly. It's some admiral in the party.
But it felt like it was in a moment that she was so desperate to want, she still couldn't actually visualise it happening.
I felt
it was skimmed over.
She cheated and copped out?
Yeah, you think she did letter?
I think
she did the, it was all a dream.
But I think it's such a literacy based society. One of the main occupations of the evenings was reading to each other.
Yeah.
So I think it, as a pure expression of someone's inmost heart, they do, when you write a letter, you do have the chance chance to set down your feelings and also, as best you can.
At the time, you couldn't really do looks. There's people all around. There's Shaq, like, that's not ladylike. Like,
I think people could look at each other.
No, it wasn't allowed. And Prince Regent outlawed it in 1819.
Well, so just to flip back, because we mentioned the Prince Regent, she was made to dedicate one of her books
to
Prince Regent.
Yes, she hated him. She was not a fan of Prince Regent.
It was Emma or Mansfield Park?
I think it's Emma, isn't it?
I think it's Emma. But she didn't like him.
He was not popular with anyone.
Oh, really?
He was a very overweight, fun guy. Vain, spent all the money.
But Regent's Park?
I don't think they were so into that. I think a lot of London was green, so they didn't need another patch. It wasn't like, thank God we've got this. Okay. No, he was not a popular figure at all, at all. And King George...
At the beginning? No, still not then?
No, because he was considered like, it was a tragedy. Like the king is being handed over to this idiot son. It's Blackadder, basically. Like that's the truth, that he was... I think he, as he got older, I think he was slightly more respected. But there's definitely a tone of like that he hadn't supported the Navy properly. He gambled. He was having affairs. Okay. He wasn't a proper man, like as in proper.
Sounds proper to me.
While we're talking about men.
Yes.
I want to talk about the incredible section at the end where she discusses men versus women.
Yes.
Just suddenly we have this absolutely fucking brilliant conversation.
And then I was like, yeah, they'll always stick a bit of feminism in there, won't they? Yeah, you know, having a nice time, enjoying a love story.
They're just having this conversation. It's her and Captain Benwick, who has sort of, we thought he liked her, but then he's gone off with someone else. But she was very kind to him. They both like reading. Yeah. So we know... In Austin World, he's a good person. And
well, actually, what I loved about what happened with her is, so he's very recently, 7 months ago, lost the love of his life.
So he's grieving.
And so she's saying, don't read those long, sad poems. Here's some recommendations, which is a bit like the School of Life, with the sort of books as therapy.
Yeah. At
certain points in your life, books can be very, very helpful.
And is this who I'm talking to? No, it's Captain Harville. Oh, that's the other captain is she talking to? Yeah. I think, apologies. It's Captain Harville, and they're discussing Captain Benwick, who was grieving for Captain Harville's sister, but now has met someone else and is very happy. And there's a little bit of, as ever with grief, everyone's a bit critical. Did he move on too soon? Is it true love if
he'd get some tweets now.
Is it true love if you can get over it? And Captain Harville is saying, a woman wouldn't have done that. A woman wouldn't have moved on, and my sister would have been true. And they have this man versus women conversation. And the bit that I almost clapped is... they're talking and you know, about men versus women, basically. And Captain Harville starts saying, you know, he basically says, well, look, songs and proverbs all talk of women's fickleness, but perhaps you will say these were all written by men. So they're having a very sort of lovely conversation. And she says, perhaps I shall. Yes. No reference to examples in books. Men have had every advantage of us in telling their own story. Education has been theirs in so much higher a degree. The pen has been in their hands. I will not allow books to prove anything. From a writer saying, like, no, like a female writer at that time being like, don't, it's such a modern argument. Like, don't come to me with your, oh yeah, but it's always been like, there's loads of examples of women doing that. And her being like, no, because you've always been telling the story. The pen has always been in your hand. That's incredible. Slip that in your novel.
Know, it's incredible, because the argument he uses beforehand is that men have stronger feelings because they have stronger bodies. So our bodies are strong, our feelings are strong.
Yeah. Which, Andy, I know you still... follow that.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of the reason I exercise, is to try and strengthen my feelings.
How strong is your sadness? Strong.
it's really strong. Not that strong, actually. Can I give you another, just a bit from the other end of the novel? I know some of the characters are caricatures.
Yes.
Walter Elliot among them, and to a certain extent Elizabeth, who's Anne's older sister. And who is really, a personality-wise, a carbon copy of her father. She's good-looking, quite icy, and quite aloof, and has never really been a true friend to Anne in the way she deserved.
Only cares about where she fits in status-wise. Exactly.
Even then, you will get these moments of really piercing humanity that Austin just casually throws in. You know, so she's writing about Elizabeth, about the family, about Elizabeth's awkward flirtation with her cousin, Mr. Elliot, in an attempt to keep the name and the money in the family, which hasn't worked out. So here we go. Such were Elizabeth Elliot's sentiments and sensations. Such the cares to alloy, the agitations to vary, the sameness and the elegance, the prosperity and the nothingness of her scene of life. Mm. And it's just...
She's so damning.
This is why this character is pretty cold, because she has prosperity and nothingness. she hasn't been made fully human by her whole life history.
And it's Anne's, like Anne/Jane Austen's ability to see people. It's like she sees through people that sometimes makes her very, very funny because she can see what someone is really doing when they're trying to be polite or they're trying to be funny. But she can also see, I feel like she pinpoints people's sadness very, very clearly in a way that you can in a novel that you, like you said, that, you know, in a film and all the adaptations, even though I think romance is often stronger than adaptations, the subtle inward life is lost.
Yes. I would say, though, this is, if we're going back to describe Jane Austen as a comedian, I do think it's very one note. I think
One star if you're a comedian. No,
it's not one star.
You're talking about one of the greats here.
No, when you get,
we both just like,
if you are summarising a whole human being in a sentence,
I think comedian's not fair.
People are a whole spectrum. Yeah. Even her, I think they are caricatures.
I think she's very good at observations.
She is the mouth. She is has the microphone, so she's able to say whatever she wants about them and drop the mic.
But at the this
isn't
is
that standoff. But that's like isn't but, that how standoff works?
That's what I mean. In order to be funny, with her central characters, she allows complexity, and with those ones that you said, sort of outer circle, she doesn't have to.
But that, no, I mean that description of Elizabeth, I think, is a brief, full insight into a whole life, which she doesn't have the pages to do a novel about Elizabeth Elliot, but she'll say, and this is the real core of this person, by the way, just so you know, bang. And then you can have comedy about that person later on, but I think completely, really, my hackles are all up now.
I know what you mean by one, I do know what you mean, but I think she's interested in characters and interested in people, and she's constantly observing, and the humour comes from observation of characters talking and how people interact. She's not particularly interested in like funny situations or like, you know, funny things happening or funny things people say. She's interested in listening too hard to how people talk and what they really mean.
And actually, I see what you mean in the one note sense, because she is painting on a really small canvas, and it's a very, very intricate painting. But as exactly that, the events in Austen's novel pretty few and far between. Yes. Someone falls off a cob here.
I know. She loves a light injury or a cold.
Oh, she loves
she?
A letter.
A debilitating
she loves
cold.
A light injury, cold, but, falling,
and
bang
that,
your head.
That was the stuff of life. Yes. Particularly if you weren't engaged in fighting the Napoleonic Wars because of your sex. And so that's the canvas. And yet on that, she's painted with such intricacy. One of the amazing things at her house, actually, when I visited, I got to see the table that she wrote her novels on.
It's tiny, isn't it?
It's the size of a big saucepan. It's so many.
At the British Museum for a while, and it just made you. It was like this symbolic of how little room, how little space a woman could take up.
Yeah, it's honestly like if you went to see a guitar owned by Eric Clapton and it had one string. How have you done that? It's extraordinary.
There's a reflection right at the end when we're sort of saying goodbye to the characters. So Mrs. Clay.
He's been sniffing around Sir Walter.
Freckles, dodgy.
Freckles, dodgy, little funny tooth, snaggle tooth. She's gone to London now with Mr. Elliot. She's been sort of manipulated that way. But she's missed by the father and Elizabeth because, and as Jane Austen says, it's only fun, because they've got the very rich cousins, it's only fun sort of following someone around if someone is following you around. And that feels, I mean, again, I still think it's one, because we only hear negative things about them. I think this is the thing, when I say, in this book...
You are going to get cancelled by the Austen Society.
In this book, when Jane Austen wants me to think a character is brilliant, like Captain Wentworth, she will give me an example of him, you know, letting a woman sit down because she's tired and I'm supposed to lose my mind. And then when she thinks a character is bad, she'll say something which again just feels very human, and that humans can have both things in them. They can sometimes think their sore throat is worse than everyone else's, but they can have redeeming...
But I think she does that. Do you think she does? Yeah.
What's redeeming about the dad and the daughter and her sister, Elizabeth?
Well, that's what, like Elizabeth, that quote from Elizabeth at the beginning, like she has nothing in her soul. It's basically what Anne's saying.
That's not redeeming.
It's seeing how people got the way they are. And I think that is a really core element of, you know, to understand all is to forgive all. It's that which Austen does so well. And when you read Austen's contemporary authors, no one was doing anything of the kind. You read people like Fanny Burney, who wrote Evelina and a number of others.
Okay, but her name is Fanny Burney. I know, and I've just heard that she existed. So of course she's bitter and upset.
Or even the Samuel Richardson, who,
well, Pamela,
you know,
yes, Clarissa.
Who did less than 1,500 pages than Austen did in 200.
Yes, yes. No, this is true.
I know what you mean. I think, sir, you know, with all authors, if you love them, you forgive them for lots of things. And there's definitely times when she'll do something that I'm a bit like, oh, what? And then I'm like, I don't care. I want Captain Wentworth.
It's more that I was sometimes going, okay, Jane, good character. Okay, bad character. Okay, I see. Rather than, I mean, what's sometimes really pleasurable, and it is a much more modern thing, is bad characters doing redeeming things. And, you know, people having more complexity.
She is painting in a palette we don't have. And I think when she does that, it's really subtle. And I can only think at the moment of Pride and Prejudice, but, like, you know, Mr. Collins is an absolute comic cameo, but she gives him this absolute poignancy and pain that his boss hates him and thinks is irritating. And every time you're laughing, you then think, oh, God, like, I actually feel sorry for him and I want him to go away because this is so painful. And I think the way she does those characters, I think what you're saying, it sounds a bit, maybe a bit modern judging.
So with Anne.
Yeah.
Little Miss Prissy Perfect.
She's all the knives are out now.
So she goes to visit a friend, 3 years older, an ancient 31-year-old Miss Smith who's been, you know, disabled by a cold.
Yeah, that was a bit hilarious, the Miss Smith story.
And because of, you know, everyone's like, why are you going to see that person? They've got no rank or status. Yeah. And she's like, oh, you know, loyalty. And then because of that character, she finds out all of this stuff about Elliot. Yeah, and actually, it saves her bacon. It saves her potentially marrying a very wrong person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the narrator says, like, see, that's why you talk to common people, because sometimes they've got some gossip. And it's at moments like that where I'm like, people aren't that black
and white. But that's why I think Anne is flawed.
Right.
Because I think Anne says to everyone, I'm doing it out of loyalty. And there's a bit of her that feels smug. But I do think that makes Anne an interesting character.
That is because the people around her are saying, don't go and visit this person. She's got nothing to offer us socially.
Yeah,
and,
true.
Bath in the early 19th century, this is Mean Girls. It is. That's how society is functioning because those are the metrics. And those are the metrics that people like Wentworth are challenging.
Yeah. But Anne definitely gets her internal status from not being her sisters or her father.
That is true.
And she's a little... dare we say it, a little smug not to be them. And sometimes I was like, look, you know what? Yes, they're awful, but they are playing the game that exists. Whereas Anne is very like, well, I'm not going to play that game. And sometimes you're like, Anne, you might need to fucking play that
game.
Also,
it's very easy to be, I'm not going to play that game if you're immensely privileged.
Hang on. We seem to be recasting Anne Elliot, one of my favourite women in fiction, as basically a spoiled, smug...
Privilege doesn't have to be spoiled. I think the narrator doesn't think
we find this more interesting than Anne is this perfect, wonderful woman who's just walking around Bath being lovely. Like, that's a boring Austen character to me. And that's what I thought, a bit more persuasion of like, oh, she's really lovely and everyone's mean to her. And I reread it and was like, no, Anne has got layers. Anne is prideful. Anne is smug sometimes.
She's very confident. She's very like, he looked at me. I can see he likes me. Twice or three times, she absolutely is assured. Oh, okay, he does have feelings.
Yeah.
So I thought she seemed quite confident.
I think that's good writing. I think if she was just... oh, goodness, my family are awful.
Then we're reading Mansfield Park.
Who is the least enjoyable of Austen's heroines. Anne Elliot, because I think sometimes, sometimes you see her father's pride in her, but just in a different way, that she's proud that she goes and visits common people. That doesn't, like, it's still a bit, okay.
But then it's the narrator who tells us that even some people who just have proper jobs do have value because they've got good characters.
The narrator is, I think she's always joking, though.
Oh, really?
She's there's very often there's a good old layer of irony on top of it.
Oh, I see. And I definitely think that often it's with a raised eyebrow.
She'll muck around.
Yeah. Okay.
You can't trust her.
We are coming to the end of such a good chat about Persuasion.
So I actually thought what we could do for an ending, you don't have to read the whole thing, but because we have a man, Andy, I thought if you could read a little bit of this letter.
Because it's Captain Wentworth's letter.
It's so fantastic. So if you could read it up to Understood My Wishes, let's have a lovely chunk of someone declaring their love.
All right. And he writes the letter and then he leaves the room.
He's in the room with her. She's talking to someone else.
He's scribbling away.
She can see him writing.
And then... he writes, he goes out.
She rips
it
open.
Left behind.
Her eyes are devouring it.
I'll be Anne, you be the man. Oh, it's very nice talking to you. I don't know what's happening over there at all.
Scribble, scribble, scribble. She goes to the very spot where he had leaned and written. He's written, I can no longer listen in silence. I must speak to you by such means as are within my reach. You pierce my soul. I am half agony, half hope. Tell me not that I am too late, that such precious feelings are gone forever. I offer myself to you again with a heart even more your own than when you almost broke it 8.5 years ago. Dare not say that man forgets sooner than woman, that his love has an earlier death. I have loved none but you. Unjust I may have been, weak and resentful I have been, but never inconstant. You alone have brought me to Bath. For you alone I think and plan. Have you not seen this? Can you fail to have understood my wishes?
Oh, come on, Sarah. That is pure. That's not about his money.
I never said it wasn't also one. I also think it's a fantasy. I think that is a form of love that we all fantasize someone will one day feel about us because they've seen us across a drawing room.
And he makes his living capturing French ships and taking all the treasure off.
You fancy him.
I do.
I fancy him. And Sarah would.
But also the ending is about how, you know, it's really great being married to the Navy. Unless you go to war, they're probably going to get hurt. Okay, good luck, everyone.
Andy, thank you so much for coming. Oh,
thank you so much.
Thank you. What a treat.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club.
You can find Andrew on Twitter at Andrew Hunter M. And his books, The Last Day and The Sanctuary, are available to buy now. And his new book, A Beginner's Guide to Breaking and Entering, is available for pre-order now. Next week's book guest is YN by Esther Yee. Sarah's novel, Weirdo, is available to buy now. And so is my book, You Are Not Alone, both available in shops that stock books.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading with you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one is coming. This one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.